If you try to send more cars down the road, the problem is only going to turn into a fuller feeling. It's one of the reasons why fiber kills cravings, because fiber slows down the transit of food from your small intestine to your large intestine, keeping that full feeling. In the next section, we'll pick up the rest of the digestive journey in the intestines, where some of the key fat-storing processes take place. U-tips. Slow the process, especially before your meal. If you have a little of the right kinds of fat just before you eat, you can trick your hormonal system by sending the signal to your brain that you're full. If you eat a little fat 20 minutes before your meal, you'll stimulate production of CCK, which will both communicate with your brain and slow your stomach from emptying to keep you feeling full. CCK release and ghrelin reduction take about 20 minutes to kick in and take about 65 calories of fat to stimulate. That way, you'll be able to sit down for a meal and eat for pleasure, not for hunger, which is one way you'll ensure you'll eat less. The average person is finished eating well before his satiety signals kick in, thus counteracting any possibility that his hormones can help him. For the same reason, you should eat slowly. If you down your food faster than a mini-vac, you won't allow your satiety hormones time to kick in. Set the early fiber alarm. Many of us associate fiber with better health and increased toilet time, but fiber is a speed bump of your GI interstate. It slows everything way down. Technically, it works by slowing the transit of food across the ileocecal valve, keeping your stomach fuller for longer. The result? A greater feeling of satiety and an increase of appetite, suppressing CCK-like signals. While you should aim for around 30 grams of fiber a day, the key is bulking up in the morning. Studies show that consuming fiber at breakfast makes you feel less hungry in late afternoon, a notorious diet-busting time of day. Great sources of breakfast fiber include oatmeal, cereal, whole grains, and fruit. Every breakfast in the U diet has a lot of fiber in it, whether it's the cereal or the vegetables in an egg white omelet or the whole wheat bread. And morning snacks like an apple also have fiber. Besides controlling blood sugar levels and decreasing insulin levels, fiber also reduces calorie intake for up to 18 hours a day. Start with 1 to 2 grams of dietary fiber before meals and at bedtime, and slowly increase to 5 grams. If you add it all at once, you will produce more gas than a Saudi oil field. The supplement konjac root also seems to have a fiber-related effect. One study showed a nearly 6-pound weight loss in 8 weeks for those who ate 1 gram of it an hour before their meals. Step down to the plate. Monstrous portion sizes are one of our stomach's biggest enemies. Studies show that when you're served bad foods in large containers, you'll eat up to 1/3 more than if you were served in smaller containers. By getting served in larger popcorn boxes, bigger dishes, and taller cups, we've automatically been tricked into thinking that availability should dictate how much we eat rather than physical hunger. You don't have to go through drastic changes to make small ones. For starters, change your serving plates to the 9-inch variety to give yourself the visual and psychological clues that you're full when your physical appetite has been sated. That's important because studies show visual clues help determine how full you are and that you may not feel satisfied until your plate is clean, no matter how large the plate is. That's also reason never to eat directly out of a box or carton and to always remember that one serving size of a food is often about the size of a fist. Slow down. Stomach growling stimulates appetite, but growling doesn't really tell you how hungry you are. It tells you to eat, but not how much to eat. That's why meal size is so important. You're hardwired to eat, but you're not hardwired to eat a lot. Having a big meal quickly won't stop you from wanting to eat a few hours later. So slow down and let your CCK act to decrease your desire to eat. Add pepper. Red pepper, when eaten early in the day, decreases food intake later in the day. Some credit the ingredient capsaicin for being the catalyst for decreasing overall calorie intake and for increasing metabolism. It also appears to work by inhibiting sensory information from the intestines from reaching the brain, which is particularly effective in reducing appetite in low-fat diets. Capsaicin works by killing or at least stunning the messages that you're hungry. So add red peppers to your egg white omelet. U-test. Are you a super taster? We all know that foods we like may send others seeking gas masks. But your tongue-related genetics may play an even greater role in waste management. It could mean that you're either not getting the right foods or more prone to downing an after-dinner pie before the check arrives. If you're classified as a super taster, you tend not to eat fruits and vegetables because they may taste very bitter, thereby putting yourself at a higher risk for certain diseases and colon polyps because you're not getting the nutrients from fruits and vegetables. You should supplement your diet with a multivitamin to ensure you're getting the right nutrients, as well as use fruits and vegetables in salads and desserts and as moisturizers on breads. If you're an under-taster, you may be prone to eating and overeating sweets because it takes more of a taste to satiate you. By the way, researchers say about 25% of us are super tasters and 25% are under tasters, while the rest of us are regular tasters. Which taster are you? The saccharin test. Mix one packet of sweet and low into 2/3 of a cup of water. That's about the size of a tennis ball. Now taste the water. You'll probably taste a mix of both bitter and sweet, but see which taste is stronger. If sweet is dominant, then you're probably an under-taster. And if bitter is dominant, it means you're probably a super-taster. If it's a tie, you're like half the population, so don't sweat it. To be sure, you may have to do the test more than once to tease out differences. The blue tongue test. Wipe a swab of blue food dye on your tongue and see the small circles of pink-colored tissue that polka dot the newly painted blue canvas. Those are your papillae. Then put a piece of paper with a 4-millimeter hole or the size of a hole punch in a 3-ring binder over your tongue. Using a magnifying glass, count the little pink dots you see in the hole. If you have fewer than 5 dots, it means that you're an under-taster, while more than 30 indicates that you're probably a super-taster.
Gut check. The dangerous battles of inflammation in your belly. We all know about the daily skirmishes that play out in the battle against obesity. You versus the ranch dressing. You versus the dessert tray. And in the title fight, your butt versus your college jeans. But it would be a mistake to think that every weight loss war happens at the table or in the privacy of your own closet. In fact, millions of little firefights break out inside your gut every time you eat or drink. And these are the most influential battles in your personal crusade against excess weight. Deep inside your eclair-encrusted gut, you have cells and chemicals that react and respond to food in two ways, as an ally or as an enemy. As we move along in our digestive journey to the second half of our digestive system, we'll explore these battles and how they influence your waistline. Here, your body doesn't just form allies or fight enemies according to how many calories a particular food has, or how greasy it is, or whether its mascot is a red-haired clown. When interrogating nutrients as they pass through your digestive system, your body classifies them by what kind of inflammatory effect they have. The enemies contribute to inflammation. The allies quiet it. We're not just talking about the inflammation that happens when your belly balloons to the size of a convention center or the inflammation that happens to your joints if you have arthritis. We're talking about the chemical reaction of inflammation that happens within your bloodstream and is an underlying cause of weight gain. This process is like the rusting of our bodies. Just like metal rusts when exposed to the oxygen in air, inflammation is caused when oxygen-free radicals attack innocent bystanders in our bodies. Inflammation happens on many different levels and through several different mechanisms, many of them having to do with food. Not only can you get inflammation through allergies to food, but you can also get inflammation in the rest of your body through the way your liver responds to saturated and trans fats and through the way your body and belly fat respond to such toxins as cigarettes and stress. In turn, these inflammatory responses can cause things like hypertension, high cholesterol, and insulin resistance. And those inflammatory responses influence the total body mother of all inflammation in your arteries, which leads to heart disease. We'll discuss these in the next section. Inflamed gut, the intestinal firefights. At the intestinal level, foods can cause inflammation of your intestinal wall through such things as allergies, bacteria, and other toxins. When food incites inflammatory responses in your gut, it's as if a grenade has been launched throughout your digestive system. Then, in response to this already damaging grenade, your body tosses more grenades to create an apocalyptic digestive war of the worlds. The effect is that the more inflammation we have in our intestines, the more toxins can enter our bloodstream. During this firefight, all along the digestive border, your body perceives a foreign intruder and assigns its special forces, mast cells and macrophages, to eliminate the culprit. These are the cells that start an immune response process throughout your body by ingesting foreign elements and alerting the rest of your body's protecting cells that intruders have entered the area. Foods that don't agree with your body's sensibilities are seen as foreign invaders. So the macrophages attack these foods and tell everyone this war is going on. This causes your whole body to start firing away at these foods and at innocent bystanders, and thus causes inflammation in your bloodstream. In that way, eating unhealthy food is really like having a chronic infection that triggers an immune response, which then causes inflammation. One of your body's goals is to get glucose into your brain cells, to feed those brain cells so that they can function. But inflammation in your body prevents sugar from getting into those cells, so you can end up wanting more glucose and eating more sugary food, which then increases inflammation and starts the whole cycle again. While we should be concerned about decreasing our body fat, we should also concentrate on decreasing our body's inflammatory response so we become more efficient in managing potential complications of our waist size. There's some genetic component to inflammation. Some of us have more than others, and smokers tend to have higher levels of inflammation than non-smokers. Most important, the process of gaining weight is often a process of inflammation. When you decrease your body's inflammatory response, you will decrease your weight and waist as well. The more inflammation you have, the less efficiently you use your food calories, and the worse you feel. The worse you feel, the more bad foods you eat to try to make yourself feel better. The more bad food you eat, the less well you can respond to the normal stresses of life, and the more inflammation you experience. And the more inflammation you have, the higher your risk of developing diabetes, high blood pressure, bad cholesterol numbers, and all of the other conditions that contribute to your increase in size and your decrease in health. Plain and simple, inflammation ages your body by making your arteries less elastic and by increasing atherosclerosis, the rusting of blood vessels. Inflammation also makes it more likely that your DNA will be damaged and a cell will become cancerous, and it increases your risk of infections. If the inflammatory mediators are fighting in the arteries, they can't be defending elsewhere, and this situation increases the risk that your body will turn on itself, causing an autoimmune response in which you attack your own tissues. For example, some forms of rheumatoid arthritis and thyroid disease. Inflammation stresses your body. Inflammation fattens your body. Obesity isn't just a disease of donuts and baked ziti. Obesity is a disease of inflammation. As we travel through the rest of our digestive journey, we'll be stopping at three digestive landmarks to see how foods influence inflammation and how inflammation influences fat. Your major interstate of food, your small intestine. This approximately 20-foot-long organ serves as your second brain, deciding which foods agree with your body and which foods cause your body to rebel like sixth graders with a substitute teacher. Your parking lot of fat, your omentum. The omentum, which is located next to your stomach, serves as your primary storage facility of fat, where you park some, or In really bad cases, all the excess foods you eat. Ideally, the garage is empty. But as we gain weight, some of our bellies are housing four stories of Winnebago-worthy fat. Most importantly, the omentum serves as the body's ultimate stress gauge. Bigger bellies indicate higher levels of inadequately managed chronic stress, which causes chronic levels of inflammation. Your post office processing facility, your liver. Your liver is the second heaviest organ in your body. The largest, your skin, is actually twice as heavy. And your liver is your body's metabolic machine. Your liver works a lot like an urban postal center, taking in all the incoming mail, nutrients, and toxins, sorting it, detoxifying it, and then shipping it off to different destinations for your body to use as energy. While the three organs play different roles, the upshot of their relationship is this. The small intestine initially processes your food, and your omentum helps store it. Inflammation occurs in your small intestine and omentum. But the big battle happens in your liver, where the mother of all inflammatory responses takes place. That's the one that makes you store fat and experience the unhealthy effects of it. Yes, we know that in your gut physiology isn't always pretty, but we want you to keep in mind our main gut goal. By understanding how food travels through this leg of your digestive system, you'll be able to identify the foods that will help you reduce harmful and weight-related inflammation. When you do that, you'll have signed a digestive peace treaty that can end the war on your waste. Gathering intelligence. They say that a woman thinks with her heart and a man thinks with his personal periscope. But when it comes to sheer anatomy, the organ closest to your brain isn't the one that flutters over a midnight serenade or the one that tingles over a lingerie catalog. It's the one that coils through your gut like a sleeping python. From a purely physiologic standpoint, your small intestine functions as your second brain. It contains more neurons than any organ but your brain, and as many as your spinal cord, and the physical structure of the small bowel most resembles that of the brain. In addition, after your brain, your small intestine experiences the greatest range of emotions. In this case, your feelings manifest themselves in the form of gastrointestinal distress. In your brain, you react to actions. You feel love when your spouse holds your hand, mad when he forgets an anniversary, humiliated when he takes off his shirt at the Bears game and thumps his densely forested chest for a shot at being on SportsCenter. Your small intestine does the same thing. It reacts to foods that enter its pathway, depending on their anti- or pro-inflammatory effect. Your food dictates whether your small intestine feels mild annoyance, a little bloating, anger, gas, stubbornness, constipation, or an all-out temper tantrums, a thar-she-blows case of diarrhea. Of course, you're the one who decides what foods you'll eat, but your small intestine works like an undercover agent, gathering information about all the nutrients and toxins that enter your body. Your small intestine feels, your intestine thinks, and your intestine performs a critical job during digestion. It helps guide you in all the decisions you make about eating, because it tells you which foods agree with your body and which ones don't. How does it do that? Through the absorption of those foods. Your small intestine has an absorptive surface area that's 1,000 times larger than its start-to-end length because of all the accordion-like nooks, crannies, and folds within it. Those spaces are where your body actually absorbs nutrients. So your intestinal absorption area isn't just 20 feet long, it's the equivalent of 20,000 feet long. No wonder you absorb so much of what you eat. When you have inflammation in the wall of your small intestine, through food allergy or intolerance, it dramatically cuts down on that absorptive surface area from about 2 million square centimeters to 2,000 square centimeters because of swelling and poisoning of the functional surface cells. And if the intestine can't absorb nutrients, you experience an upset stomach and diarrhea. While we're all familiar with those overt emergency intestinal crises, our intestinal emotions also influence us in ways we don't normally associate with food. The reason we may feel groggy or have less energy than a drained 9-volt could be because our intestines are trying to tell us we're choosing the wrong foods. If you pulled out the small intestines of your entire family and laid them on the back deck to compare them, you'd see that they all look alike. They're the classic wormy tubes that wind through your gut. In terms of basic physiology, we all have the same intestines, just as we all have the same basic brain structure. But just as all of our brains don't function the same way, even though we have the same parts, our intestines don't function the same way either. Our intestines are as different as our smiles, as our laughs, as our political views, as our fetishes. A particular food can make one person feel energized and make another person feel as lethargic as a rag doll. Anatomically, your intestinal wall is Clint Eastwood tough. With more than a trillion bacteria living in your intestines at any given time, most of them helpful, but at least 500 species of which are potentially lethal, your body protects itself with a fortified infrastructure to keep the bacteria out of your bloodstream. But your body, though it relies on that Fort Knox-like wall, has to have a way to give clearance to authorized visitors. That is, it needs to allow nutrients to get through the wall to your bloodstream so you can use the food as energy to keep your organs functioning, to go to work, to pry the kid's fingers from the panicked frog's leg. One of the ways this penetration system works is through bile, which tricks the wall's security so fats can get through to the bloodstream. This selection of what stays in your intestines and what can cross the line is one of the least understood anatomic processes, but it's part of the inflammatory battle that plays out daily in your body. When your intestinal wall is inflamed, some unauthorized visitors get in. Essentially, alien bacteria are living in your intestines, trying to get into your bloodstream to multiply and cause havoc. But they're being fought at the intestinal wall by those who guard it. Your gastrointestinal tract, but especially your intestines, are one of the three places where your body interacts with the external world, your skin and lungs being the other two. In your small intestine, your mast cells and macrophages, which are part of your immune system, serve as the bowel brigade fighting alien invaders. When foods enter the small intestine and are transported across the intestinal wall, they're met by this bowel brigade border patrol, which screens the nutrients. The bowel brigade lets the foods through because it has an authorized ID card. It's food, and your body wants it. But if it's the wrong kind of food, or it's got some toxins with it, your bowel brigade responds by calling in more mast cells and setting off time-released bombs throughout your intestines. This is where the inflammation firefight starts. The result? Pain, gas, nausea, or general GI discomfort. Why is this crucial? Not just because of the initial inflammatory reactions, but for the role it plays in your eating emotions. Your small bowel is your second brain, and 95% of your body's serotonin, which is a feel-good hormone, is in your gut. How you feel influences how you eat, and how you eat influences how you feel. When you eat food that makes you feel bad, you self-medicate with food that may make you feel good in the short term, but will actually contribute to both inflammation and weight gain. Ultimately, when you're caught in a cycle of feeling bad and eating worse, you create a chemical stress response in your body, one that's handled by your parking lot of fat. The storage of stress in your belly. The best way to tell how stressed you are, take a look at how much belly fat you have. The larger your waist, the higher your stress. along the intestinal freeway, the parking garage for fat that is your omentum looks like a stocking draped over a hanger. Your stomach is the hanger, but changes depending on how many calories you're storing. In a person with little omentum fat, your stomach looks as if it has nylons hanging off it, thin, permeable, and with some webbing. But in a person with a lot of omentum fat, the hanger looks as if snow pants are hanging on it. The fat globules are so fat that there is no netting or webbing whatsoever. While cells can convert to fat in the liver, getting fatter is more a case of your existing cells growing. When you add body fat, you don't get more fat cells, you just get more fat in each cell. Genetics certainly help dictate whether you're going to have a full garage or an empty one. But your lifestyle, in terms of stress, often plays a bigger role in deciding whether you'll have large amounts of belly fat or not. Here's how it works. Historically, mankind has two types of stresses. The first is the immediate soil your loincloth stress. In other words, the dinner-seeking saber-toothed tiger is closing in fast. In that fight-or-flight scenario, your body produces the neurotransmitter norepinephrine to speed your heart rate, breathing, and the 100-yard dash time to the cave. When that happens, the last thing you're thinking about is grilling up some tubers on the campfire, so your hunger levels are squashed. That's because your body inhibits the peptide NPY during periods of acute stress. It's why exercise cuts appetite, because your body senses that you're in acute stress. So high levels of stress work in favor of your waist. They take away your appetite and speed up your metabolism. The second kind of stress that early man faced is the chronic struggle brought on by drought and famine. In contrast to the 30 or 40 seconds they sweated over tiger fangs, our ancestors worried about survival all the time, and their bodies had to deal with chronic stress. When they faced famine, they sought out as many calories as they could, and their metabolism downshifted to help them conserve energy. While we don't deal with famine, we experience the modern-day version of chronic stress that makes us seek out calories and then downshift our metabolism. Our bodies respond by storing the excess energy to call on during periods where there may not be enough food. Those extra calories are stored in the omentum, our abdominal fat depot, to have on hand in case we are denied food. The liver, which is the relay station for energy circulation in the body, has immediate access to this omental fat, unlike the cellulose cluttering up the back of our thighs. When people are under stress, their bodies release high amounts of steroids into their bloodstream in the form of the hormone cortisol. In acute cases, the tiger or a car accident, steroids stick around briefly. But when you're under chronic stress, the drought, or the nagging task, your body needs to find a way to deal with those high levels of cortisol. So your omentum clears the cortisol steroids. It has receptors that bind to them and can suck them out of the bloodstream. Unfortunately, this doesn't necessarily reduce the stress levels you feel. The steroids turbocharge the ability of the omentum to store fat, so your belly fat becomes the best surrogate indicator of how well you are really coping with stress, despite what your brain may be claiming. That uptake of steroids throws your body into metabolic disarray by making your omentum resistant to insulin so that sugar floats around without being absorbed and without being used appropriately by needy cells. This, first of all, chronically raises your blood sugar, which damages your tissues. Secondly, it supercharges your omentum with inflammatory chemicals that destabilize the delicate equilibrium of your hormones. And third, it forces your omentum to pump high-octane fat directly into your liver to make even more inflammatory chemicals. The fight against inflammation. The liver, the organ that's responsible for your metabolism, receives its blood and nutrients from your gut. What it wants isn't the trans fat from the extra-large fries. It wants other nutrients, the protein from the meat, the carbohydrates from the bun, the lycopene from the tomato, the calcium from the cheese. The liver is always on the job, processing munchies after midnight as well as 5 a.m. coffee. Your liver takes every chemical in your body and processes it by binding it to a protein, transforming it into something your body can use. So your poor, overworked liver also gets the toxic trans fat directly from your intestine and from your omentum via that portal vein that feeds right into it. When your intestines send that convoy of fat pouring down into the vein, the liver sees it as a runaway train and tries to metabolize the foods. But in defending the body, additional inflammatory chemicals are released. In your liver, nutrients can be met by two substances. In our digestive town along our intestinal highway, let's think of one of those as the raucous frat house that stimulates inflammation, while the other is a nice, stately, non-profit group that quiets inflammation and performs good deeds throughout your body. Eating foods that stimulate your liver to release the frat house substance, which is called nuclear factor kappa B or NF-kappa B, triggers a chain of events that causes the inflammation in your body and prevents the transport of glucose to your cells and thus triggers hunger. Glucose on the inside of cells stops hunger in the specific satiety center of the brain. But you can also eat foods that stop the inflammation riot or foods that stimulate the release of the do-gooder substances that have an anti-inflammatory effect. They're called PPARs. It stands for peroxisome proliferator activated receptors, but we like to think of them as perfectly powerful abdominal regulators. The reason why PPARs are so effective, once they're activated, they decrease glucose and insulin levels, as well as cholesterol and inflammation. Though we all have different genetic dispositions for levels of PPARs, PPARs aren't self-starters. They need to be activated by foods to work. Now, if you look at PPAR and NF-kappa B at the cellular level, you can also see how they predispose us to obesity. Every human cell is run by DNA strands that carry blueprints for future growth. When the DNA mutates, it makes our cells less able to reproduce themselves rapidly and accurately, so our bodies age. What makes the DNA breakdown? Yes, inflammatory responses in your body that cause oxidation, your body's rusting processes, namely in the form of increasing NF-kappa B with inadequate PPAR levels to put out the inflammatory fires. How do we stop that mutation, that oxidation, and that inflammation? By eating foods with antioxidant and anti-inflammatory properties, foods that we'll cover in the waste management plan. These foods are particularly useful for those who are aging and unable either to exercise or to manage stress efficiently. This is one of the primary battles you want to win, to quiet your inflammation and decrease your fat storage through the regulation of these two chemicals and their allies, to quash those hooligans living in the NF-kappa B house. You need to increase the effects of the noble PPARs throughout your body. The stress response, putting it all together. Today, we don't experience drought or famine, but we do have high levels of chronic stress, whether it comes in the form of workload, relationship troubles, or to-do lists that are longer than Route 66. And our bodies respond the same way as our ancestors' bodies did. But the difference is that we have plenty of food at our disposal. Chronic stress triggers an ancient response of calorie accumulation and fat storage. So we end up continually upgrading the size of our omentum storage unit. Here's where the cycle of fat spins out of control. When you have chronic stress, your body increases its production of steroids and insulin, which increases your appetite, which increases the chance you'll engage in hedonistic eating in the form of high-calorie sweets and fats, which makes you store more fat, especially in the omentum, which pumps more fat and inflammatory chemicals into the liver, which creates a resistance to insulin, which makes your pancreas secrete more insulin to compensate, which makes you hungrier than a muzzled wolf, which continues the cycle of eating because you're stressed and being stressed because you're eating. Interestingly, the more fat you store in the omentum, the more it reduces the effect of stress on your brain. It's your body's way of comforting you, assuring you that you'll be prepared during times of famine. It's why your omentum fat, the fat around your belly, isn't just an indicator of the size of your waist, but it's also your personal gauge of the size of your stress. U-tips. Let food fight the fight. Your best weapon against fat isn't a Tybo video or self-serve liposuction vacuum. It's food. Good food. Inflammation-reducing food. To reduce obesity-causing inflammation, you need to eat foods with nutrients that can do just that, either by having direct anti-inflammatory or antioxidant properties, or by stimulating the do-good PPARs or inhibiting the party-throwing pledges in the NF-kappa-B frat house. Antioxidants are often what gives a specific food its flavor, smell, and color. So eating more anti-inflammatory foods means eating more flavorful and brightly colored foods. The foods you eat ought to be tasteful. You can magnify a flavor by doubling up on it with two different food sources. For example, add sun-dried tomato bits to tomato sauce, or eat dried apples with applesauce to bring out their flavor. Here is a list of nutrients that seem to have antioxidant and/or anti-inflammatory effects and are recommended doses. While they may not help you lose a ton of weight, they're known or thought to have anti-inflammatory effects, which will help you live healthier no matter what your weight. Omega-3 fatty acids found in fish oils seem to increase the number of PPARs, which will help reduce your inflammation. We recommend you get omega-3s in the form of 3 4-ounce servings of fish per week, or 2 grams of fish oil capsules a day, or 1 ounce of walnuts a day. Saturated fats, by the way, increase inflammatory properties, and trans fats undermine the effects of omega-3s. Green tea. The thinking is that the cachechins in green tea inhibit the breakdown of fats and also inhibit production of NF-kappa-B. Studies have found that drinking 3 glasses of green tea a day reduced body weight and waist circumference by 5% in 3 months. It also increases your metabolism. All non-herbal teas have substances that increase the metabolic rate. Beer. In moderation, Tiger. The bitter compounds that come from hops derived from beer seem to activate PPARs in animal studies. But you have to get them in the form of only 1 drink a day. People who drink 21 8-ounce beers or 21 glasses of wine or 21 shots of whiskey a week have a clear correlation predisposing them to belly fat, independent of all other risk factors. Turmeric, a ginger-like plant that has curcumin as its active ingredient, turmeric seems to activate more PPARs to reduce inflammation. Just add the right dose, a pinch, 1/8 of a teaspoon. Add any more and your food will taste like mustard. Jojoba beans, they're really seeds. They've been shown to tune up the system in ways we want, like increasing good cholesterol levels and raising leptin levels to curb hunger. The supplement jojoba extract seems to work by stimulating CCK. The dose is about 2.5 grams to 5 grams for most people, 50 milligrams per kilogram of weight for you keeping score at home. Drink Java. Coffee is America's largest source of antioxidants, aside from caffeine, which has its own antioxidant properties. It's chock full, pun intended, of polyphenols and is a great low-calorie food when you have cravings. You can drink decaffeinated versions to avoid the side effects. The second biggest source of antioxidants? Bananas, which have 7 times less than coffee. Go through the process of elimination. To change the way you feel, the way you process food, and the way you store fat is to get at the root of the system. You need to figure out what foods may be causing your GI trouble, no matter how subtle your symptoms may be. The best way to do that is through the food elimination test. What you'll do is completely eliminate certain groups of foods for at least 3 days in a row. Sometimes the elimination of a food takes 2 or more weeks to show its benefits in how you feel. During that time, take notes about all the different ways you feel, your energy levels, your fatigue, and how often you go to the bathroom. Take notes when you eliminate foods and when you reintroduce them. That way, you'll really notice what changes make you feel worse or better. Here's the order we suggest. Wheat products, including rye, barley, and oats. Dairy products. Refined carbohydrates, especially sugar. Saturated and trans fats. And artificial colors, which are tough to get rid of because they're in everything. While the experiment will help you ID your personal digestive destructors, it has an added benefit. Eliminating a group of foods for several days at a time will help train your body to eat smaller portions all the time. Get moving after a big meal. If you've made a mistake and gorged on a tub's worth of food, make your body work in your favor. Stay awake for a few hours and take a 30-minute walk to help your body with the breakdown of nutrients so that it uses the food for energy rather than stores it as fat. Once the calories are in your stomach, don't try to vomit, which can damage your stomach, burn your esophagus, and even discolor your teeth if you do it enough. Also, don't eat sweets after gorging because sweets increase insulin and help deposit excess calories in your belly. Pick your poison. High amounts of sucrose cause inflammation. You can reduce the effect by using alternative sweeteners. Besides causing sudden spikes in blood sugar, foods with high sugar content have high caloric content, and if not burned off or used as fuel, those calories will be stored as fat. While some sweeteners are low or no calorie, there is a downside. Sweeteners found in diet soft drinks, diet foods, and on restaurant tables next to the sugar packets go unrecognized by your brain. They're essentially invisible to your brain's satiety centers, so it doesn't count them as real food and still desires to be fulfilled by calories somewhere else. There's no clear-cut proof of the effects of these sweeteners, either on a health level or a weight loss level. But we do know one thing. Prehistoric man wasn't putting Splenda in his water. Artificial sweeteners, while lacking calories, may have side effects like intestinal problems and headaches. If you're having a hard time losing weight or don't feel well, these are some of the first things to cut out, even though they can be an alternative to high-calorie sugars.
Taking a fat chance, how fat ruins your health. It doesn't matter whether you're trying to shave a few inches from your waist or trying to morph your slushy belly into an ice-hard one. The fact remains, it's hard to forget about body fat. You see it when you get dressed, get washed, and get jiggy. You feel it when you sit down, when you walk upstairs, when you bend over to lick the last cake crumbs off the plate. And if you're a person who struggled with weight for a lifetime, you likely stress about fat more than you stress about money, relationships, or anesthesia-free colonoscopies. Fat is constantly right in our faces and on our minds and wrapped around our necks and arms and hanging from our bellies, raining from our rears, and gyrating during twist contests. But you know what? Oftentimes we forget about fat. We eat a lot of food at one meal and go back to do it right again because we don't see the health risks in the same way we see a slightly larger chin in the mirror. Now that our digestive journey is over and you've learned how fat is stored, it's time to explore what the excess stored fat can do to your heart, to your arteries, and to your entire body. Most of us assume that you have to be as skinny as a coaxial cable to be healthy. But the truth is that plenty of so-called thin people are less fit and less healthy than so-called heavy people. That's right. It's actually better to be fat and have few risk factors for bad health than it is to be thin and have a higher number of health-related risk factors. Now, that's not to say we're ordering a round of fried pickles for everyone. When all else is equal, carrying extra fat will more likely increase your risk of heart attacks, strokes, and diabetes. But our point is that we want you to stop thinking about pounds and pounds only. We'd rather you start thinking about the numbers that really matter, especially to your husbands, wives, children, parents, and friends. The real story of your body isn't measured by scales or wolf whistles. It's measured by your waist size and what fat does inside your blood and arteries. What's fat got to do with it? Here's how many of us assess our health. If the pain's not severe enough to call the paramedics, then we tough it out, go on our way, and write off most of our general feel-bad symptoms to fatigue, stress, age, or the jug of vanilla fudge we downed during CSI. The problem with that approach? You're probably more in tune with the fall TV schedule than you are with your own body. Of course, if you're overweight, the extra fat is sure to manifest itself in some outward side effects like lack of energy or lack of self-esteem. But many of the risk factors associated with carrying too much fat don't have any outward symptoms at all, meaning that the only way to tell whether being overweight is threatening your life is by taking a microscope underneath the flub and chub and focusing on what's happening at your body's most core levels. Sure, you know that fat lives on your hips, but it also lives in your blood. If you were to take a vial of blood and let it sit, you'd see a layer of clotty cream that would rise to the top of the vial, sort of like tiramisu. That's fat. How did it get there? It's absorbed via your intestines. But the key player is the omentum. And why should we care about that organ that sounds like it's missing the letter M? Because the omentum can store fat that is quickly accessible to the liver, meaning it can cause lousy cholesterol and triglyceride levels to rise, and also sucks insulin out of circulation, making your blood sugar rise. Meaning that this cream-converted fat sets up shop in the omentum and puts your organs within very close striking distance of a hammer. See, fat is like real estate. It's all about location, location, location. We all have three kinds of fat. Fat in our bloodstream, called triglycerides, subcutaneous fat, which lies just beneath the skin surface, and that omentum fat. As you can remember from the last section, the omentum is a fatty layer of tissue located inside the belly that hangs underneath the muscles in your stomach. It's why some men with beer guts have hard-as-keg bellies. Their fat is underneath the muscle. Because this omentum fat is so close to your solid organs, it's the best energy source. Why go to the gas station on the other side of town when there's a station at the next corner? Think of the omentum fat as the obnoxious 18-wheeler on a crowded highway, elbowing out the stomach, pushing away other organs, and claiming up all the space for itself. What's most interesting and encouraging is that as soon as you make physiological changes to your omentum, your body starts seeing effects. That is, once your body senses it's losing that fat, then your body's blood-related numbers, cholesterol, blood pressure, and blood sugar, start traveling in the healthy direction. Within days, before you even notice any kind of physical sign of weight loss, especially when you consider that the size of your omentum is impossible to measure without a CT scan. In addition, the fat released from the omentum travels to your liver rapidly and constantly as opposed to the more patient fat on your thighs. The processed material is then shipped to the arteries, where it is linked to health risks like high LDL or lousy cholesterol. The other problem with omentum fat is that it secretes very little adiponectin, which is a stress and inflammation-reducing chemical that's related to the hunger-controlling hormone leptin. When you have less fat, you secrete more adiponectin, which produces a product that reduces inflammation. But more importantly, higher levels of adiponectin are related to lower levels of fat. So the more omentum fat you have, the less fat-regulating adiponectin you'll produce. Those who have low levels of adiponectin have abdominal obesity, high blood sugar, high blood pressure, and high cholesterol. These are all risk factors associated with coronary artery disease. Those are the reasons why the fat in your thighs is more important to your health than omentum fat. And they help explain why omentum fat, or an apple body shape, is more harmful than subcutaneous fat, like thigh fat, which gives you a pear shape. Subcutaneous fat isn't supplying a feeding tube to the rest of your vital internal organs, and it's not messing up the levels of substances in your blood that are being supplied to your vital organs. The closer your waist is to ideal, the healthier your arteries and your immune system will be. The healthier your arterial and immune systems, the longer and better you'll live, and the more energy you'll have every day. Highways to health. Before you know what's inside your arteries, you need to know how they're structured, so you can see what kinds of damage they can sustain and what kind they can't. Made up of three layers, Your arteries are the monorails of your body. They transport blood throughout your body and deliver nutrients to all of your organs. Inner layer. The innermost layer of your arteries, the intima, comes in contact with blood. It's slippery like Teflon, so blood can easily flow through. This normally smooth layer helps protect the muscular middle layer, the media, and is the layer most susceptible to attacks from outside sources. The middle layer. The middle layer of your artery supports the entire arterial structure by working a little like a hand squeezing a hose or a boa constrictor squeezing a neck. When you're depressed or anxious, the layer can constrict, narrowing the amount of space where blood can flow through. But it also has an advantage. It can release tension by dilating, like the hand releasing the hose, to pull the Teflon layer outward and open up more space in the part of the artery where the blood flows, say, when you exercise. When that happens, it allows more red cells, oxygen, and other nutrients through. You feel more energy when that layer functions like it did when you were 9 years old. Outer layer. The outer layer, or adventitia, shields the artery from the rest of your body like sausage casing. It holds the artery together from the outside. Under normal circumstances, the inner layer is lined with delicate cells, and blood runs freely. Think of the structure of a tile wall. It's a smooth wall made up of individual tiles connected with little gaps throughout. In the tile wall, you have white gooey grout. In the artery, you have tight junctions holding the cells together. Now, in your arteries, that wall will stay tight unless something comes along and starts chipping away at the junctions between those smooth cells. The most damaging tile buster, high blood pressure, is the arterial sledgehammer. But plenty of other pickaxes can chip away at the arterial lining. Cholesterol, nicotine, high levels of blood sugar, stress, anger, and about 40 other smaller risk factors, primarily stemming from lifestyle choices you make. The effect? They chip away and cause little nicks in the intima of your arteries. And those injuries trigger the anatomical starter's pistol. The race to destroy and repair your arteries is on. The effects of fat. For years, you've been used to looking down at a scales needle to determine your health. Wrong needle, bucko. What you need, a needle in the hands of someone who can draw your blood. With results from a simple blood test, you'll find out what your current settings are, and then be equipped with the data you need to take steps that will reset the settings to the factory originals. Blood pressure. These days, blood pressure machines are everywhere, at the pharmacy, in your gym, in mall kiosks, even in Walmarts and McDonald's. That's good. Actually, it's great. Get your BP, hold the fries. That's because you need to track your blood pressure, your most crucial vital sign, even more diligently than Roger Ebert tracks movie openings. High blood pressure still reigns as the leading cause of heart attacks, stroke, heart failure, kidney failure, and impotence. While most of your other blood numbers reveal levels of substances inside your blood, your blood pressure gauges how your blood travels throughout the body. Simply, blood pressure refers to the amount of force exerted by your blood on your arterial walls as it passes through. It's measured through the systolic pressure, the pressure being exerted when the heart contracts. That's the top number. And the diastolic pressure, the pressure in your arteries when the heart is at rest. Now, if the force of that pumping is too high, it'll gouge holes in that smooth inner lining of your arteries, causing those nicks in the tile wall that trigger a chain reaction of grouting, then destructive inflammation, and clotting. Think of it as the beating of a bongo. If you hit a bongo with your fingers, the drum head will stay intact. But slug away with two baseball bats, and that bongo head will feel like a roach in an exterminator's crosshairs. Your goal? Treat your arterial walls with a nice, steady rhythm. Let your blood tap, tap, tap them, not pound, pound, pound them. Certainly, many factors can make your blood pressure soar higher than an Albert Pujols home run. Stress, high levels of the mineral sodium, lack of the mineral calcium or potassium from not enough fruits and vegetables, lack of physical activity. But it's also clear that being overweight leads directly to high blood pressure. This happens in part when the kidneys, squashed by fat, feign death unless they are fed with a higher blood pressure. Your kidneys are the organ primarily responsible for regulating blood pressure. Luckily, you can reduce your blood pressure quickly and dramatically by addressing your waist issues. Losing 10% of the weight you've gained since you were 18, that's only 4 pounds if you've gained 40, can result in a decrease of 7 millimeters of mercury from your systolic pressure and 4 millimeters of mercury from your diastolic one. The message is clear. Drop your waist and you'll drop your blood pressure. Cholesterol. Hear the word cholesterol and you likely think of eggs, heart attacks, and a mandate from your doctor. But cholesterol is part of your body's arterial repair kit. It's designed to help you, though it doesn't always happen that way. Let's go back to those nicks in your arterial wall. Whether it's blood pressure, nicotine, or too many cheese curls that damage the wall, your body gets angrier than a cinched up bull, because it doesn't want the middle lining of the artery exposed to blood. So your body hires a handyman to patch up your nicks with grout to cover the wounds in the inner lining. What's that grout? Cholesterol, but not just any old cholesterol. Your handyman, let's call him Lester, carries two things, a bucket of grout and a spatula. The grout can come in the form of lousy cholesterol, which is carried by low-density lipoprotein, or LDL. It's big and puffy and prone to breaking up and scattering bits of cholesterol when it hits the walls of the artery. When your LDL levels are too high to begin with, maybe from your diet or from your heredity, and then you nick the inner lining of one of your arteries, Lester goes crazy and slaps on more and more and more grout. He starts covering up the damage with the bad cholesterol, loads and loads of bad cholesterol. But look inside Lester's tool belt. He's got a spatula that takes premium-grade grout in the form of cholesterol carried on high-density lipoprotein. It's the healthy HDL cholesterol. Compact and powerful, the spatula works with this slick stuff to take away the extra gunk. Now, if you have too much of that LDL grout and not enough of the premium version HDL grout, it can lead to a chain reaction of events that has a potentially heart-stopping outcome. We'll call it the fats domino effect. Domino 1. Having too much bad cholesterol not only means you'll have too much junk or plaque in your arteries, it also means that LDL cholesterol will get into the middle layer of your artery. That cholesterol in the middle layer acts like a drunk fan with courtside seats, making the environment much more hostile than it's used to being. The presence of LDL cholesterol in that middle layer stimulates the immune system to attract white cell protectors to try to smooth out and calm down the rotten cholesterol. Domino 2. Those white blood cells, in turn, spill some of their toxic contents that normally attack infections, and that causes generalized inflammation. Domino 3. The toxic contents in the cholesterol are soaked up by scavenger cells, building up blister-sized spaces in the walls of your arteries. They're called foam cells, and they increase the size of the plaque, or grout, even more to make the artery surface rougher. Domino 4. Sensing something's wrong, your body responds with more inflammation, creating bulges and potholes in the wall, often in the area of weakness, where a scar was trying to form over the dangerous plaque. If that plaque ruptures into the middle of your blood vessel, the next domino falls. Domino 5. These rough patches in the wall then attract sticky blood platelets to form clots in your arteries. Normally, platelets are good. They help form scabs to heal wounds. But when they hit that rough patch in your arterial wall, they grab the lining and form a big clot on top of an irritated, inflamed plaque. And this brings in more clotting proteins to the area that act to cement the platelets in place. Domino 6. All of this gunk piles up faster and faster, and the inside of the arteries becomes so inflamed that the platelets and clots fill the entire artery. This ruptured plaque process takes minutes rather than decades, so you can influence its likelihood today by making the right choices about food. Domino 7. The blood can't get through the artery, and nourishment to the heart is shut off. Game over. The chain reaction triggers a heart attack. Or, depending where the process happens, it can cause a stroke, memory loss, impotence, wrinkled skin, or any number of health problems that happen when blood flow malfunctions. As you can see, it's not the cholesterol by itself that's so bad. It's not having a high enough amount of the healthy cholesterol or a low enough amount of the lousy cholesterol that can thwart the process before it even begins. And it's not doing things like normalizing your blood pressure and blood sugar to help decrease the chance of developing nicks in the first place. While genetics dictates some of your cholesterol level, your physical activity levels and poor food choices, things like trans and saturated fats, simple sugars, and too many calories, really dictate whether Lester carries the right amount and kind of grout, or moves the spatula fast enough to make for a nice, clean wall. Blood sugar. Yep, we know how it is. You don't have diabetes, so you're going to blow off thinking about blood sugar faster than a flight attendant blows off a flirty coach passenger. And that will be a mistake. Blood sugar is another substance that can nick your arteries if levels are too high. You may think your level is normal, but most blood sugar levels are recorded when you've fasted. Having normal levels for fasting, which is under 100, or for after meals, which is under 140, is important. Why? Because there's a good chance that even with normal blood sugar levels, your blood sugar may rise significantly throughout the day as you eat. Studies show that men with a waist of 40 inches or more have 12 times the risk of getting diabetes compared with men with a waist smaller than 35 inches. For women, having a 37-inch waist is that much riskier than having a 32.5-incher. The most sensitive way to diagnose diabetes is to measure the blood sugar fasting, and again, 2 hours after taking 75 grams of sugar, to see how your body can deal with the sugar. Many people think that diabetes is a purely genetic disease, and of course, it sure would be nice to blame Aunt Mabel for this medical condition, but it doesn't quite work that way. For type 2 diabetes, your environment, that is your lifestyle, your behaviors, your macaroons, is a much more dominant trait than genetics. Yes, type 2 diabetes is a genetic disease. If you're a twin and you have an identical twin who gets type 2 diabetes, you have the genetics for it. And it's a tough disease too. Diabetes ages you 1.5 years for every year you live. For example, if you get it at age 30 and live to 60, you're not really 60. You have the energy and disability risks of a 75-year-old. Here's how it works. Insulin in your blood normally takes sugar and puts it into cells. But in people with type 2 diabetes, the transfer of sugar into your muscle and fat cells is inhibited. While nice in coffee, that sugar in your blood chips away at your arterial wall by weakening the junctions between the cells that form the surface lining of your arteries. Ultimately, it allows holes to form in these junctions. By causing your insulin levels to go haywire and making proteins in your bloodstream less effective, sugar really behaves like nutritional cocaine. Omentum fat contributes to type 2 diabetes by making it difficult to get glucose inside the cell and let insulin do what it does best, deliver glucose. Simply being overweight, especially having a waist greater than 37 inches for women and 40 inches for men, makes your body less sensitive to insulin. The insulin receptors on the cells don't allow insulin to transmit the message enabling glucose transport into the cells, leaving the glucose to float around in your blood. That omentum fat is also selfish. It uses up the insulin so it can't do its job. One study shows omentum fat sucks up 1/4 of the insulin that passes through the blood supply. So your blood sugar level remains high because the sugar isn't being admitted to your cells readily and thus isn't broken down properly, meaning that sugar will hang out in your blood like a truant skipping school and causing mischief. So what? Well, having too much blood sugar in your blood is like having too much rain in a small pond. The flooding can cause damage for everything around it. Too much blood sugar can. 1, weaken the junctions between those smooth endothelial cells lining your arteries, making the Teflon-like lining more vulnerable to nicks. 2, increase the power of the hammer. That's high blood pressure. Sugar turns the hammer into a sledgehammer. 3, cause your white blood cells to stop fighting infections, thus weakening your immune system. 4, trigger a chemical process in your red blood cells, which transport oxygen in your bloodstream, that causes the cells to want to hold on to oxygen more tightly. That keeps oxygen from getting to your tissues. When that happens, the glucose, like a lost puppy, attaches to whatever it can find, most likely proteins in your blood and tissues. These proteins deposit in tissues, leading to the development of cataracts, joint abnormalities, and lung problems. 5, it can get in your nerves and cause a reaction that makes your nerves swell, become compressed, and lose their ability to function, usually in the parts of your body farthest from your brain, your hands and feet. 6, it can flip off a switch in your small blood vessels. Normally, your body automatically regulates the flow of nutrients into your small blood vessels. They sort of work on backup, like a generator for when the power goes out, so they can function even when your big vessels might experience some problems. But high levels of glucose turn off that automatic regulation and let a little high blood pressure make more of those nicks and tears in the junctions between your cells and your smaller blood vessels. This is like asking someone to use a sledgehammer to do the job of a jeweler's tool. It magnifies that effect and magnifies the size of the nick. But here's the thing. You can control your genes if you want to. To keep blood sugar levels down, you should avoid foods with simple sugars and lousy aging fats like trans and saturated fats. And about 1,000 calories worth of activity a week, about 30 minutes of walking a day and 20 minutes of the U workout 3 times a week, causes your muscles to be so much more sensitive to insulin, which allows sugar to do its duty inside your cells rather than cause havoc in your bloodstream. A little physical activity goes a long way. Arterial inflammation. When we think of our arteries and what can damage them, we tend to think of that clog, the hunk of junk that stops the flow of blood like a lemon seed in a straw. If there's a roadblock in the way, then there's no way for traffic to move through. But that's only one mechanism for closing off blood flow. The other occurs through the process of inflammation. Typically, inflammation in our bodies makes us think of things that swell out, like a sprained ankle or swollen gums or the shiner from a 2 a.m. bar brawl. But when it comes to arterial inflammation, you have to think about swelling in. In response to all that clotting action we talked about with LDL cholesterol, inflammation occurs in the middle layer of your arteries. As the middle layer swells, it pushes into the inner layer because the outer sausage layer doesn't give. That pushing into the inner layer reduces the size of the hole that blood can travel through, like drinking with a thinner straw. One of the ways we determine potential cardiovascular risks is by measuring chemicals in the blood that signal inflammation. C-reactive protein, or CRP, is one such chemical. Elevated CRP indicates an inflammatory reaction somewhere in the body, from a sinus infection to gum inflammation. If it's high, your risk of heart disease is greater, because any significant inflammation in your body increases inflammation in your blood vessels. Fat chance, the other major risks. We're not here to lecture you and pummel you with statistics about health risks. But to put fat in perspective, remember that it's an all-body risk factor with complications everywhere. Even if your numbers in some health categories are as perfect as a Michelle Kwan triple toe loop, you're not risk-free. Being overweight or obese leads to the following. A higher risk of cancer. The inflammation resulting from omental fat also causes dysfunction in the system that protects you from cancer. In fact, there's a direct correlation between waist size and an increased risk of hormonally sensitive tumors, such as breast cancer in women and prostate cancer in men. Fat contains an enzyme, aromatase, which converts adrenal hormones into a long-acting kind of estrogen, which can cause increased risks of breast cancer. A higher risk of sleep apnea. Fat around your waist correlates with a thick neck, and that can obstruct your breathing. You're at a higher risk if your neck size is more than 17 inches. In its benign form, snoring, you can still move air through your throat, but you generate a kazoo sound that violates OSHA requirements and can cause permanent hearing loss and marital strife. In some cases, that obstruction worsens until eventually no air can pass into the lungs for up to 10 seconds at a time. Fortunately, the body instinctively awakens prior to suffocation. As you get older, the tissue in your throat softens and the area around your tonsils attracts fat. When you're asleep, your muscles fully relax, the tissue collapses, so there's even less room in the back of your throat. Sleep apnea makes you miss out on deep, restorative REM sleep. This leads to frequent awakenings at night, lack of sleep, and daytime drowsiness. You're more likely to develop NIC-causing high blood pressure, caused when your lungs hang on to carbon dioxide when you stop breathing. And, the bitter irony, you're more likely to get fatter because of it. That's because sleep apnea is like a series of rear-end collisions, one accident after another. The lack of sleep makes you tired. You feel like you need more energy. You eat foods that give you quick energy, but also have higher sugar content and fat. You get fatter. You continue to have sleep apnea, and the cycle continues. As an incentive to embrace a good eating plan, most people will lose fat first in their faces and